Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And I'm Nicholas Jitkoff from the Material team.
Material team. So Android Material? Material?
It's more than just Android. It's many things. There's webs and there's other platforms too.
So Material is interesting because when it was first being developed, and you can correct me since you're actually on that team and you know far more about this than I do, when it was being designed and developed internally, it was much more than Android. But I think Android, just given the timing of things and also the release cadence that we had in Android and the people sort of focused on those aspects of it, was sort of the first or most obvious implementation of that.
And it was also the place best suited to try to do some exploration there, because there was a willingness to evolve it and define it.
True, but when you say willingness, so there's always a tension.
Those Chrome people are so hard to work with.
You really want the designers to bring to you something that A, is done, and B, will actually work. And in reality, that never actually happens, right? So designers will iterate towards something that they're happy with, and they want to explore it with the engineers. The engineers go off and implement their best attempt to do this thing, which is physically impossible usually. And then the designers will take a look and go, you know, that's not quite what we had in mind. How about if we do this instead, which when it requires a complete rewrite, ends up with a lot of heartache and fisticuffs.
Yes, but doing it in a iterative way with engineering usually leads to the best result.
It does. It does. It's just, it's
harder.
It's harder. You really want the prototype tools to be good enough that you can sort of do that iteration without requiring sort of rewrites of platform code. But there are nuances. Like Shadows is a great example, right? So that took a lot of work to get what the UX group wanted out of Shadows.
And we didn't know what we wanted to begin with. It took Christian going off into a garage with some lights and pieces of paper to figure out what was right.
There's that aspect too, but it was also like there really was a tension. It wasn't like, well, what if you do this and that, you know, the original definition of that thing would be, you know, impossible to do, certainly at the frame rate that we require. So then you make trade-offs, and then there's a question about, you know, what were those correct trade-offs, or what should we change the definition of the problem such that we, you know, the trade-offs aren't as extreme, and then there's sort of that back and forth and optimization. So anyway, so it started out as sort of the Android implementation of what the Android UX, mostly Android UX group was doing. I think that's where most of the design was focused, again, because that's where the original implementation was. But there was also stuff going on with Polymer at that time and in other groups, because Material was more than this Android implementation. And now it's a bit more obvious, right? There is this Material group that is not the Android Material UX team.
Right. And a lot of it started separate from Android to begin with, where there was the original web redesign that happened in 2010 and 2011 timeframe. A lot of the enthusiasm for like coming up with a consistent presentation for our own apps started then, and there was more work between the different design teams. And as that extended into the Android team, like they brought more into it, like color and dimensionality, and that was what ended up becoming sort of the first Material styles.
Okay, after a big dead pause in the air. So I'm sort of curious where it did start, because from my perspective, which is vastly different from yours, I saw it as finally a definition that allowed us to have some consistency, right? Because I think this is one of the things that we were recognizing in the platform, but I don't actually know where it began, right? So we had the hollow thing that we had done on Android, which brought some amount of consistency that we had not had before. But I don't think it was all the way there. So at what point did the design group or particular designers sort of step back and say, this is not enough, we need, you know, a physical system that we're basing on or whatever?
I think the important thing was creating a fiction that people could use to unify the way we approach it. So the engineering and the design side, having sort of the physical system and the materiality of it was a way that we could converge what people expected from it and have the implementation more closely matched sort of the intended design, even if it's unspecified. Like, as you know, there was large chunks of this that were specified late or were evolving over time. But being able to describe it in terms of this should work like a real object, I think made it easier for anybody working on the Shadows or working on the design and the layering of the apps to know what the right approach is.
And it seems even trickier when you're defining a system that is supposed to be self-consistent and based in some, you know, unique physical system in and of itself, but it's not physics, right? These are not pieces of paper. Instead, you're like, well, we have this concept of paper and ink, and the paper can stretch. And like, well, I've been using paper for a very long time in my life, and it doesn't stretch.
The intent was to capture the core elements that made it feel realistic without being limited by it. Right. Having like paper doesn't stretch, but it doesn't feel weird when you see things on screen move that way. It's sort of partly why we're defining it as a ambiguous material that is sufficiently enhanced that it can actually do these things. But we didn't want to take a lot of the baggage that would come from being like truly realistic, where it would take both a lot more processing power, but also limit what people were capable of doing.
And paper cuts. Well, if it was surreal on their phone.
It would be very skeuomorphic. You'd end up with, oh, right. I'm using leather.
Yeah. So there's just enough there to let people know about how the thing is structured, how the thing might move, but not so much that it takes away from the focus of the app.
Right. But then it seems like it took the extra amount of, you know, effort and design time and iteration to define what this other system is, because then you couldn't just borrow from reality and say, well, obviously it would behave like this. Then you're like, well, if we have this, you know, imaginary substance that is paper-like, what would it behave like in the following situation? Then you have to define those parameters such that they are consistent with when people adopt it in different situations, right?
Right. And we wanted enough flexibility, so having some of this stuff not entirely defined is beneficial. It'd be nice to have other apps and products use different styles, and maybe they become a little bit more skeuomorphic or a little bit less, but whatever is appropriate for the use case.
So the original 2D rasterization system in the UI toolkit is it's called Skia. Chrome uses the same rendering engine, so I always thought that Material was maybe a skeuomorphic system. just want to leave that.
That's a long setup for a pun.
Yeah. Well, you know what? When we go back and post, we'll edit this down, and it'll be such a tight setup.
Yeah.
It'll be amazing, and then the laugh track will cue as well.
No doubt.
So where did the paper and ink come from then? Right, that's sort of the foundation of a lot of the, you know, physical reality that this stuff is based in, or the pretend physical reality.
I think part of it was the desire to recapture what we had seen in graphic design and print in the past. Like, there is a lot more attention to white space and attention to how things are placed on a page, and evoking that for people made them think about the apps the same way they would think about laying out a magazine. We didn't want everything to be wedged into corners. We wanted things to have room to breathe. So describing things in terms of ink, I think, helped focus people on having the additional white space and think about typography and placement more. Paper emphasized the aspects that I described earlier about layering and showing the surfaces that are actually independent or movable. Even though, again, it's not behaving exactly like paper, it's something that people are familiar with. They know they can drag it around. You can put things on top of each other, and they cast little shadows. There's a simplicity to it and a subtlety to the layering and the shadows that are caused by paper that we felt would direct people in the right into the right styles and not be too overblown with like other types of materials might.
But it seems like motion was a major factor too. Hollow felt kind of, I don't want to say dead, right? But it was pretty, but it didn't really move. And it seems like material is so much about things moving.
But a lot of the motion you'll see, 90% of the motion is actually a fairly subtle, like this thing is sliding from one place to another. Yeah. There are aspects of it that are particularly refined, that things aren't moving along straight lines. They're moving along curved arcs that pick up a little bit from what people have done traditionally in animation that make things feel more real than a real thing would feel. Mm-hmm. But it's to make things not exactly perfect so that they speak to what people would see in the world.
I was thinking that, so you were relating the use of paper and ink to some of the white space elements that we have, you know, giving everything room to breathe. I thought that was a nice design term. Thank you for that. That seems like it actually builds on previous things that we were doing in some of the Google apps that were not material, but maybe that's like a material, you know, version 0.1, right? Where we'd made changes in, I don't know, Gmail and the web. Where we just gave everything space. We didn't have, you know, the programmer's view where everything is 8-point font crammed together as densely as possible.
And we had lots of discussions about how dense things should be, particularly around email. People care about how many messages show up on a screen. The original explorations, like part of what you saw there was a push for better typography, consistent iconography across the applications. That was one of the main things that the web redesign did. It was a little bit more minimalistic and harsh than the material ended up being. It was completely flat. There was no dimensionality to it. So you had to use lines or color to separate parts of the screen. I think the evolution into material added this extra dimension, this extra thing you could add to define how things are structured and led into the ability to do the motion work. Because a lot of the motion stuff would feel very mysterious if it didn't have the layering as a reasoning for it.
Right. There's another element that I'm remembering at the same time as we were exploring the space stuff. And I remember the Gmail web app specifically, but I'm sure this was across many of the apps and spaces. But there was the use of the red button, and it was very strange because it's like it's just a color. Why does that matter? But it was the first time that I had seen that as like this is a common action thing as opposed to this is a warning on your screen that you should totally avoid.
Yes.
But it came from, I think, the simpler color scheme that they were using at the time. It's like, well, it's either black or if it's text, or it's white if it's the background, or it's this, you know, red thing that you're going to click on to, you know, get your inbox or whatever it was, or write the message. And that's not where Material went, but it seems like they sort of built on that because it broke it down to simpler colors, right? Yeah. Flat colors for, you know, the actions in the backgrounds and stuff.
And that first thing, what you saw was the desire to unify the Google properties. And so there was a very rigorous palette of like it's sort of black, gray, white, red, and blue, green occasionally. Like it was those core colors and the primary action, which eventually became the fab, like that bright button was a way of making the apps look and feel like each other. What happened is it went into Material, though, was it was less about Google and more about all the third parties and like being able to handle a variety of different styles. So the fabs aren't locked into a specific color. Google apps tend to pick ones that are pretty consistent. A lot of the changes that were made for Material were to adapt it to a platform where other things would be built upon it and not be conveying entirely Google in it.
It certainly lent itself well to the ability for apps to then theme themselves, right? So they didn't have to bake in all these assets with their company colors. Instead, it's, you know, we've just got flat assets that you can tint along the way.
Right.
I don't know if that was the original intention, but it certainly worked out nice architecturally. In the system so that, you know, it makes it easier for developers. It makes the APK smaller because you're now have all these PNGs for background colors, essentially.
And I think developers often do more as they go. But early on, like one of the easiest things to do is like set an image, set a color, and have sort of the basic theming. And then you build upon that with a little bit more branding in variety of ways in motion or in other kinds of imagery or illustration or photography.
So I was going to get into this later after we got deeper into Material, but it's kind of a nice segue into branding. So there were changes that have been made in the last couple of releases. So going into L, where we did the major Material stuff, and then more recently, some of the branding type stuff that we're seeing in the launch screens in Marshmallow.
What? Launch screens?
The
Aren't
screens
you supposed
that
to
you
not
see,
have those?
The screens that you see when you launch an app. So what I have seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like some of what we're doing is trying to unify the types of experience that apps can have. The problem that I've seen is that apps will do a zillion different kinds of things when they launch. And this is, you know, whether it's Google apps or external apps, you have apps that say, we don't want a starting window because, you know, for whatever reason. So then you click the icon and it takes 3 seconds to launch and you basically stare there at the home screen waiting for the app to suddenly magically appear with everything in it. Then you have the apps that do the default thing, so you get a starting screen where it's essentially blank with the theme of the application, and then you get the application. I think that's a reasonable default for apps to go for, and that's certainly why those defaults exist. Then you get the apps who don't quite understand that system, so they'll let the splash screen happen with the theme that's defined by the application, then the application comes up with a completely different theme. And then you have what I feel is the worst transgression, which is typically games, maybe because they kind of operate outside the system of the SDK in general, where they'll have a splash screen because, like, I don't know, they never ran their app to see how horrible this looked. They run the splash screen, they get this default window, and then after that, they get a custom window, which is their own splash screen. So that takes a few seconds. Then their splash screen comes up with a completely different custom full screen look, and then their app comes up. So you get, like, three screens coming up, all of which look completely different from each other. And so it seems like some of what we've been doing in the launch screens that we're seeing in Marshmallow is maybe trying to at least give a pattern or guidance for a way to brand your application and give the users a consistent experience. Is that how far off am I?
That's very close. I think in particular, the splash screen implemented post-launch was the thing that I most hoped that we could avoid, like a best practice that just helps people get an image up at a time when it's not going to impact the overall launch time and then get the app running as soon as possible is ideal. Like the goal is to make the system feel responsive. So I have come from working on web stuff in the past, and like the white flash on page loads was always one of these problems with the web. It's unavoidable because there's a period when the thing is not ready to go. And I think Android has sort of they've had a better solution with sort of the theme showing up earlier on, but in many cases it wouldn't exactly match the app that you were going into. And in fact, in the when we spec this out, we spec'd out two reasonable things to do on launch. One is to put up a placeholder UI for your app, which the theme itself is a pretty good approximation of it. Other elements can also be put on, but that makes the app feel like it is almost immediately loading. The splash screen is an alternative to it. The launch screen is an alternative to it in that it helps you tie back to the icon that you tapped on originally. That it is a continuation of that part. So in either form, you're continuing either the icon that you tapped on or the UI that you're going into. So it feels like it's part of the same state. One of the things we saw as we moved from K into to L and M was in removing the app icon from the upper left-hand corner, which was used previously as sort of the hierarchical up, there wasn't as clear way to do branding. We liked removing that and that it simplified things. And there are many cases where people will put back a logo and they should. But the loss of that, many of the apps started to feel very similar. And so using branding on launch, even temporarily, reminds you of the place that you're going and sort of brands that experience without having to have persistent elements on screen. So particularly for things like games and others where this was just sort of the way it was happening, the desire was to have a best practice either for the branded launch or the placeholder UI.
So did we also consider using the audio system instead so that as you're using this application, it would just constantly remind you you are currently using Gmail? I mean, that's a possibility. I'm just saying.
We need a Zombo app.
So a what?
Zombo.
Zombo. I do not know that term. We'll look it up later. There's a search engine I've heard of. Yes, Tori.
So I've seen on Google Plus and Twitter some developers sort of very passionately advocate against splash screens. Have you heard their arguments? And, you know, how does that factor into this? Because I think that what they're saying is that we apparently used to encourage people not to use splash screens, and now we are violating that ourselves. And second of all, I'm just wondering how much overhead is it to have a splash screen? Like, if they're saying that it makes the app startup slower, are we talking 20 milliseconds or like... Okay, yeah. Oh, Chet's raising his hand.
Ooh.
This is a podcast.
I'm sure Nicholas has responses for this too. So to be clear, we should actually probably remove ourselves from this podcast because we have a conflict of interest because we worked on this stuff together, right? So
Tor
should
talk about it,
ask
sure.
And answer
anything
all
you
the
want
questions,
to know,
right? So the trick with the splash screens, and we worked very hard in this, was exactly what Nicholas was saying: was you don't want to cause the app to have to load first and run a lot of logic in order to put up that splash screen. That absolutely is something to avoid, and it's something that we don't like developers to do. Like in the game experience, or in the experience where someone's not going to have, you know, starting window, but they're going to have a custom splash screen which does something really fancy. It takes 4 seconds to get there. What is the point, right?
Yeah.
So instead, what the system was that the design group came up with is using the existing mechanism of the theme window, but instead of having a blank window with the correct theme color at the top, you can have a background drawable that's anything you want, right? So it's just as fast as that. It basically loads the drawable, slaps it on the starting window, and it's there almost immediately.
Right? And almost immediately is?
Almost immediately is basically the time that it takes to come up with the starting window, which is going to come up anyway, which is, I don't know, 300 milliseconds on a reasonable phone.
Well, that'll happen no matter what, without a splash screen or not. But it's just the bitmap
plus,
decode, basically, yeah. And that's the only cost.
Bitmap decode slapped on top of that.
And it happens before the launch animation even starts. Like from the moment you tap, when that animation is coming up, it's already done.
So right. In other words, it's not noticeable to the user that this app did this in terms of delaying startup.
Right. It's not delaying startup at all. In fact, it uses the existing mechanism, which is always basically get the starting window up as fast as it can, load in a different process in the app process, the app itself, and when the app is ready to display, it crossfades quickly between them. Right. So as soon as the app is actually ready to go, the user is going to be seeing that app. And this isn't doing anything different. I think the reason that people are noticing it and wondering, I haven't seen the chatter about it, but I assume that they're wondering if this is causing a delay because now it's doing something richer. Right.
Yeah.
So you're actually seeing the app icon. There must be, you know, more logic of why am I being forced to watch this
thing. You're running splash activity and then after that it'll do an intent to do another one. Yeah.
But it's actually doing exactly the same thing it used to. It's just doing it more meaningfully. With more materiality. I like that word.
So
is that a word? You used that word earlier, materiality. I'm going to start using that one a lot.
The other thing is, as I said before, the ones that we have chosen ourselves to do are using the iconography. Part of it is to make it feel like the thing that you tapped is the thing that has grown up to become the app window.
And that's, so it's a good practice to include the launcher icon or some
larger
version.
We have done
it
because it emphasizes that materiality. It's like the icon itself has grown up to become this thing. It's all like the single surface that is taking you from step to step. That's like the continuity that comes from that was one of the reasons we chose to do it. Other folks may have like larger word marks that are more appropriate to use. In general, the wonderful launch animation makes it feel like it's expanding from that location anyway, so many things will work.
Right.
But again, it adds this feel of responsiveness to it and ties it back to what you tapped on.
Okay. Sold.
Okay. All right. So
yeah, I have not heard any reason why you shouldn't use the splash screen.
Survey says. Okay. So then returning back from Segway, we'll pop out of that call. Material. So what are the elements that you think are most important about material from the stuff that came out of Lollipop, but also going into Marshmallow? Was there still more that like we hadn't gotten to in the L release that we were continuing to work on or are continuing to work on?
I was surprised by how much we got into the L release. A lot of the major pieces were there, and the refinements in M were mostly that refinements. I think that what we're still like sort of building out are sort of more components. Like I think that in M, the addition of any additional work around sort of the design library and other things, those are sort of the long tail that we're excited to keep doing. But the core stuff around sort of the presentation and the visuals was pretty nicely set in L.
And are basically all the apps now migrate, at least the Google ones, are they migrated fully to Material, or are there more things we have to-dos in our source code or whatever to do, like, hey, we really should have a hero transition from this activity to that activity?
I think there's a lot of refinement around transitions that are still going on. I think that we're trying to strike this balance of sort of subtlety and then polish when it's appropriate. In many cases, we will have like too many animations, and we're trying to refine those down, or things that aren't they're flashy, but they're not necessarily realistic, and that's one of the things that we're trying to around them build best practices. It's some of the animations get a little bit hard if you're doing anything more than sort of sliding a surface and moving into a new location, but in practice, sliding surfaces around and like very basic affine transforms are the things that feel right. We're going to keep working on sort of motion guidelines for people and try to build out reusable implementations of them.
I would encourage you to keep working on refinements, because the longer we can just keep refining the thing that we have, the longer it's going to be till the design team comes to the toolkit team again and says, oh, well, we have a new system. So if we can just keep pushing that one off, that'd be a good thing. First, we have to clean up all the dead bodies from Lollipop. There's still litter in the hallways. From our perspective, like the major effort really was in the Lollipop release, just getting all the fundamental plumbing in there. And then the M release, like there was some optimizations for shadows, because that is one of the more technically challenging aspects of all the stuff. There was slight API refinements, but I think more of the focus was on some of the work that was done in the support library for DesignLib. So these were not, you know, required components, but it was common things that the spec pointed to that are not provided as part of the framework. So can we help developers and give them a leg up and also provide more consistency? So we can say, well, it's easy to do with Fab. It's, you know, it's this circle thing in a container somewhere and there's an elevation. And then people come back with completely different implementations that don't look similar. Then you kind of want to provide the fundamental plumbing. So you say, okay, use this thing, and then you're going to look like the other people that are also using that thing.
And that's the process we took from many of the different components. Like, we'll build them out and spec them. We can build them in our own applications. We'll see how internally we use them. We see how external folks use them. And then as it's appropriate, we build out shared code for that. But there's so many different pieces of this. As you said, like, we threw a lot at you all that we need to see which are the most valuable to turn into a component to share.
So I have a fair idea of where Material is at with Android. How to proceed with other platforms? Like, are we starting to use that in other, at least Google apps, or see other apps in the web that are using the web standard or the web version of this stuff?
We are generally encouraging of like any third parties that are doing stuff. Like, we've seen a number of third parties use it for their web properties. For our own sake, we use Material as a language across all of our platforms. And the the implementations of the different like Polymer and Angular and others, like they're all continuing at very high speeds, all slightly disjoint from each other, but all extremely enthusiastic.
Also, that sounds like a description of the web overall.
Yes, but we have a wealth of different options for doing sort of web material style web, and we're working with them to sort of consolidate the styles across those so they're a little bit more consistent. But it's actually just nice having like three or four different options as far as people go. Our own properties, because we have so many different front ends, they utilize different ways of implementing it.
Do you have a favorite in terms of who's, you know, which app has implemented Material the best?
Which app on the web?
Well, I know, for example, I used the web version of Google Play Music, All Access, whatever it's called. That's, you know, seems really well done in terms of they do all kinds of stuff. So I'm not sure if I'm missing some other app that's doing it better.
Music's quite good, partly because they have so much good imagery that they can use.
Oh, yeah.
The new Google Plus redesign's actually excellent, too. But partly because they leverage this like same style across many different platforms. They're probably one of the first that has actually done that cleanly across all and done that sort of like dynamic resizing of the web down to smaller sizes. I think we're pushing more and more of our apps. Inbox was also very good, but Inbox was one of our first examples.
Music was interesting too because they had a nice experience on the web, but they also were one of the first apps on Android to really take on a lot of the stuff like the activity transition stuff, as well as, you know, a lot of the subtler transitions.
Yep. And many of the examples that we did, well, the studies we did while defining the system were in Music because it had good images and we knew there would be images and they'd be loaded in time and it'd be great.
Assume a system where you have a full bleed image, which Gmail, it doesn't really work for them that well.
But
scale.
Well, there's all
text.
The attachments with all the HTML stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
They can work with that. Yeah, maybe they could do like circular reveals on the attachments all the time.
The Inbox is doing more and more because they have sort of the large images for cities for travel and I think some product stuff too.
Plus all the bundles, right? They usually have some nice images for that, right? So you get some email related to whatever and there's like a, you know, picture of, an, you know, if you have a dinner reservation, right? You know, you get the email confirmation, you get some like graphic of like a glass of wine.
Inbox and calendar. Like we did a lot of illustration and imagery work with them.
I'm trying to imagine my Gmail inbox like creating pictures for me of
We said inbox, not Gmail.
Sitting around a table having a meeting, like over and over again, clip art of people in a meeting.
You have the wrong people you email.
Apparently. I'm not on the interesting conversations.
I get GIFs all day long, and so it's just like the entire thread is just full of like these animated, it's impossible to use.
Okay, other elements of Material? Let's see, where is it? Where are the rough edges right now that you are trying to refine? Or are we done?
The motion stuff, as I mentioned, like a lot of it was do these things, but we weren't exactly clear on the specifics and how. And I think that we're working a lot on both the nomenclature that's involved with it, as well as better support for how to, like better support for the implementation so that designers and engineers can seamlessly work together rather than having to do a lot of back and forth to decide what will actually work and what looks good at the same time.
Right. So do you think that part of the problem with the motion stuff is that the spec is unclear on the details, like it doesn't give enough guidance? So you gave the example earlier of, you know, those animations seemed, you know, gratuitous or not physically based or whatever. Is that because they misunderstood what the spec was saying? The spec doesn't really nail down the details, or we just need, you know, more information about or more thinking about what it is that Material motion is?
Part of it is understanding how to apply motion to existing applications. Like having to re-architect an entire app just to get some animations is not pleasant.
So I've heard.
Yes. So in many of those cases, identifying like what are the things worth spending time on? Like what is the animation that happens over and over and over again? And then making sure that's a reasonably subtle and polished thing. But then also for people who are building new apps, having recommendations as they go and best practices as they go for how they should weave it in that doesn't get in the way. So making sure that as people build apps new that they land in a place where they can actually get those animations for free or with very little effort.
So slightly different topic. I was thinking about the fab, and that's something to me that like it totally makes sense. It's consistent with, you know, a lot of the elements in design and Material overall. On the other hand, I could also see that as something that, hey, that's a really cool idea in 2014 and 2015 and maybe in 2020 that's an idea whose time has passed, right? There are elements of design that are fad-based or like they were really cool and then they start to look dated because they got overused or whatever. Like, and I'm pointing at that one, but that's just an example. Like, are there elements of material that could go away? And like, this is a more meta question, how does design evolve as opposed to having to reboot? Because, you know, that then it becomes self-inconsistent. Like, if an element like the fab is so so
floating
material to the entire construct that if people don't want to use that anymore, then you have to, like, redesign an entire new system.
Were you saying both fab and fad? Are you calling the fab a fad?
I just know that. Yes. I used to also come to the meetings for the whatever that project was called before it was called Material. And I swear, I was there for a month before I realized what a fab was, because everyone was always using fab, and I felt too, you know, embarrassed to
floating action button.
Exactly.
I tend to play the dummy in the room that will eventually ask the question, and that I finally asked that, and all the designers looked at me like, you are the dummy in the room. How do you not know what this is? And we were like 2 months in at that point.
Yeah, that was my point. It's like, oh, it's so long, I have to.
Yep.
I think the presentation of the fab is something that is sort of tied to a current style. If you look at our previous apps, like the compose button in Gmail that was red, that was a very similar, the intent was the same. And I think the intent is somewhat timeless, which is the, like, you should have a primary focus of the application and let users know what the thing is. So as a forcing function to just have people consider that, I think it works very well. The actual form it takes will change from app to app. And in many apps, it's not actually a floating action button. But if there is a primary action somewhere on screen that is highlighted through color, through positioning, through shape, that is what we're really after. And in some future place where we come to you for a redesign, which will never happen, I'm sorry.
I'm sure it won't.
It may change the way it looks. But the intent will be the same, that there is going
to
be something
there. The fab is
dead.
You heard it here first.
The fab is not dead. The fab is... It's a symbol for something important.
He highlighted that as the one thing you probably would change next. That's what I took out of that.
I'm just curious how systems evolve in general, because certainly on the engineering side, we look at something like that as that's an interesting detail that could certainly change given, you know, whims of popular opinion in the future. Therefore, that's not necessarily appropriate for core framework. Right? Core framework is like the plumbing that will always be there. You must always support. You know what? We're always going to have buttons. They may look different, but there is always going to be the concept of a button. That belongs in core framework. Whereas you look at something like, I'll call it a fab, but I just mean like any random thing that comes up that's a good idea this year. We're not sure whether we want to bet our future on it yet. That is more appropriate for a utility library where people have the option of opting into it. Right. So I can choose to use that, but it's not like it's part of the core framework that I am expected to use.
Right. And its presence in the framework will drive more people to use it, and it may not even be an appropriate thing for a given application. Like, there's actually been many UI reviews we've done with people where just like, you shouldn't have a fab here. Like, it's in something like music where there's just big things on the screen that are the things that are the primary action, or in more utilitarian apps where it doesn't make sense. People are a little bit more biased towards using it, but it's worth the trade-off because the having people think about what the primary action is more important than actually having the button. As far as building stuff into the frameworks to support it, like, I think the main things it does around having a surface that expands and can become other things, that's what's going to be important. And it may not actually be a fab that is expanding or taking over the screen as we get into motion stuff, but it may be like an album that you've tapped on or an email or something else. The implementation of sort of these surfaces turning into other surfaces is the important part. And whenever possible, like, that's what we should be driving towards in the frameworks.
Right, which is certainly something that we tried to do in the Lollipop release as we were basically building the fundamental building blocks of making this thing work. It wasn't, how can you make something on the screen look like it might be a shadow? It was, how can you build a system that is representing what shadows would be given a certain definition of a light source, you know, at a certain point in space of a certain area, like, actually defining the system so that that worked, and then it gave us the shadow that was what the design team wanted. In the meantime, we have a system that supports that kind of lighting model, right? And then there are different ways to use that system in the future if we do, you know, change the design of, you know, how we want elevation to work, right?
Right.
So on the framework, it really is about, like, getting a consistent system to work that supports different functionalities as opposed to, you know, hard coding everything to represent a certain look and feel of 2015.
Yep. I think y'all have done a good job, which is why you hear from me less, because we can do everything on our own now.
I wondered. I thought I had said something wrong. You don't call anymore. So that was material. I actually did not know you at Google until you started appearing in all these meetings telling us to do all this difficult stuff in the L release. But apparently you'd been around for a while doing other stuff.
Yeah. So I started as an engineer on like the Mac client team. So building out things like Google Desktop and updaters and other things like that. But I started meddling more and more in the design side and then realized that's what I wanted to spend my time doing. So ended up switching over to design, working on Chrome OS, and then basically Chrome has almost no UI to work on. So when we got to a point where we felt like it was actually pretty good, I turned my focus towards the web, which was where a lot of our apps were built. So that's when I sort of had been involved in that redesign. And so in 2011, we had all that sort of stuff.
So you were involved in the pre-material stuff that we were talking about earlier as well. Okay.
Yes.
Right.
And then there was that process got all the designers in the company kind of stirred up and excited about working together again. And that, after a couple of years, became sort of these material efforts.
Is this when we were arguing about how many lines were visible in Gmail at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you can
that
imagine,
was a pretty massive fight internally.
Yeah. If you can imagine a company the size of Google, even Google then, basically made up of 140% engineers, and you have made less text appear on the screen at any given time. There were very few people that were happy about that decision outside the design group.
And just three options were born: cozy, comfortable, and compact.
As long as you
They're
give power users an option, you know, as long as they can go back to the way that things were, dang it, then it's all good. So what was it like making the change from engineering to design? Was that motivated by your interest in design, or were you just tired of designers coming and telling you what to do?
There were fewer designers back then, so it was easy to be both engineer and designer on a product. It's just that I spent more and more of my time on the design side. In practice, like part of my design process involves prototyping on any given platform, and I think many designers have one or more additional skills outside of their design focus. So it's all about conveying ideas to people.
Do you find it helpful to be able to go and actually code up something if you want to prototype and see how something feels? Or do you tend to use fully scripted?
I do whatever requires the least effort generally. But for some things like Chrome window management or the Chrome tab behaviors, it was often easier to build out the full logic. Mm-hmm. The full logic with like no comments and like poorly done and extremely buggy, but then like you could have a conversation with engineering and build it out into something real. Mm-hmm. But there, in Chrome in particular, there are a lot of problems that unless you have your own data in visible, the prototype is useless. And I think Search and others have this problem too. Of like you need real data, you need like the user's actual web history in Chrome in order to design a history UI.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people are like, "What is this site about hairbrushes and other things I don't understand?" So
do you have a favorite prototyping platform now for the more general design explorations you're doing, or are you always product focused? Are you always looking at Android related things or Polymer or Angular or whatever?
I'm probably overly biased towards the web, just because you can get it onto anything. So like you can get something that approximates the UI onto Android or onto a Chromebook or something. It's because of so many of the efforts I've worked on are about sort of unified presentation of UI. Just having a web page you can load on any of them that adapts to that size is exceptionally helpful, and it requires the least amount of effort to do. When you start getting into places like where you require deeper API access, the first thing I do is I will build out a shell to provide access to those to a web page, and then when that's not enough, I will often go into the native versions. So it's, again, the least amount of effort necessary in order to convey an idea to people.
Interesting. So I remember most of the prototyping going on for material during L actually coming from design tools instead. And that was around, the shadows work or a lot of the animation stuff. The catchphrase on the team at that point, at least the engineering team, I don't know if we told you guys about it, was, well, it works in After Effects.
It would be hard to prototype shadow behaviors, using web tools.
The ripples were
you really want like a 3D modeling thing.
Yeah.
there was the 3D modeling. There was also the motion modeling as well. And like we don't, you know, if we don't have the APIs to support that animation, then how exactly are you going to describe this rich experience, right? So that was the appropriate. It was the appropriate tool for designers to sort of work through the ideas that they had, but then they would tend to come up with ideas that were really difficult to implement or sometimes impossible, right? And then you do the iteration.
One thing, and then I'm going to also take us on a tangent. The ripples were the one thing that we did as a web implementation of just sort of trying out the style and the fall off the ripples. That was a web prototype that me and like four other folks were handing off and working on.
I remember Alan talking. I'll use the word talking about the fact that he was basically translating logic from JavaScript into what it needed to be.
And it was problematic because the web implementation was this like frame-based simulation of how Ripple would go out, and then the Android implementation was a was defined in terms of like states and the easing curves between those states.
Not a one-to-one translation.
No, but the feel was conveyed, and you actually could try it on a device.
Right.
So it got us close. If we knew that the final implementation would have been more sort of keyframe based, we would have done it that way. It's just
interesting. And the tangent?
The tangent was After Effects, and like one of the problems we are facing is like people doing things in After Effects and them not being able to translate into something real.
Yep.
In particular, people doing canned animations in After Effects that even if you implement them to the letter on the platform, they don't feel right. I was going to point out that like what will make motion interesting and complicated over the next few years is the fact that it's actually got interaction that is driving it. So canned animations or even like animations that are based off of a one-dimensional drag and things are like rotating slightly as they go off axis, they don't feel realistic. So tools like After Effects can like force people down a path where something is overly specified and not in the right way.
So do they feel good in that tool? I haven't worked enough with After Effects to understand that dynamic.
You just have a huge amount of control. Like you can take everything from one point to another with like loop-de-loops and whatever else you want, but it doesn't take into account that the user may be like biasing slightly upward as they're dragging this thing or slightly downwards. And in some cases, it worked out really well where it's like you tap on something and it animates to a new place on screen. That is essentially a canned animation, and it may be based off of the location on the screen, but the moment you get to something where you're actually pulling a drawer up or you're squishing something down or rotating it or moving it at the same time, it's impossible to convey all the possible variations that would happen as you're doing that. And you may be able to convey the feel, but it will require an engineer to fully understand the intent and then implement it separately.
Are there other tools that work better for that? I know Flash authoring was this sort of weird mishmash of design tools as well as, you know, code sprinkled on frames, which I never quite wrapped my head around as an engineer.
Yeah, there are a bunch of tools. The Form, which is one of the companies we acquired and are working with internally, like they have built out a node-based approach to this where like you can define the interaction of touch and the way it affects the things in a more visual way. Stuff like that, I think, is sort of the best approach to it. There's still a disconnect, but at least it starts. Designers who are building with something like that will have a better sense of what is possible and what should be done. People have a different sort of palette of stuff to work with. It's not going to be like here are the curves and here are the timings of the things going from one place to another. It's like you have input and you have like the resistance that's involved with this and the size of the thing, and you actually have a fair amount of control, but you're designing and implementing something that is completely dynamic and is changing while you're interacting with it. It's harder.
It is harder, especially when you get the canned animation from the designer.
Yes.
And you go, I don't have any idea how to make that work in code.
And that requires a lot of back and forth. And
Yep. Painful discussions. Yep.
And even the things that are a little bit more interactive, like when we were talking about the ripples, like that was a lot of back and forth to try to figure out how to do it right. That's an area that we can do much better in.
Did we end up at a happy place?
You just need to take like all these videos that you've done and then feed them into TensorFlow, and then like it can understand what it should do, and then you could query it. You know, so you have something that understands the intent based on the examples that you provide.
Okay, and then you can get rid of all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone has to feed it those. You know, keep feeding videos of Catalyst. You know, examples so that it can generalize.
You can just connect it to Dribbble. It'll be fine.
Yeah, to be clear, whenever I complain that things are difficult, it's actually a happy feeling because it means that I'm still employable. So, you know, as an engineer, I'm happy that things are difficult to engineer. So Keep it coming.
At least we're going to say they are. Oh, yeah. Super complicated. Super complicated.
I wouldn't know how to do that. We're going to have to spend a lot of time thinking about that one. I'm kind of all out, Tor. Yeah. You've been talking a lot this episode, so you should probably, I don't know, shut up now.
I'll try.
Anything else you want to talk about? Childhood memories?
Oh, no. Don't bring this back.
Then I think we're set. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.